I grew up among Christians, and I praise the Lord for the Christians that I grew up among who loved the Lord, loved the Bible, committed to Christ, devoted, willing to sacrifice almost anything for the cause of Christ. But most of the Christians that I grew up among, I think it would be accurate to say, did not have a great appreciation for John Calvin. And in fact, some of them would have been quicker to denigrate him than to honor him. And certainly Calvin was not a perfect man. You can find things in his life that I'm sure he is unhappy about now that he's with the Lord, wishes that he could go back and do over, as all of us do. Is there anybody here who doesn't have anything in your life you wish you could go back and do over? But the more I have learned about the life of Calvin over the years, read his works, learned about his life and influence in ministry, the more amazed I am at his godliness, his humility, his knowledge, and the influence which he had upon the Church of the Lord Jesus Christ, particularly in the Western world. Next to Martin Luther, he was the key figure in the Protestant Reformation. Some would say that his influence was greater than Luther's. It might be hard to evaluate that. Maybe our doctor has an opinion about that. But I'll tell you what, once you've named Luther and Calvin, you can't find anybody else who even comes close. And God used these men to spark what we call the Protestant Reformation, which really was a return of the gospel. And we are here today, spiritually speaking. We enjoy the freedoms and the understanding of the gospel and the liberty that we have today because of the life and ministry of John Calvin. Some of that life is going to be presented to us today by Dr. Ed Panosian, who is here with his wife, Betty. Dr. Panosian taught 52 years at Bob Jones University in the area of history. He's been retired now for 6 years. Was chairman of the Department of Church History, and also in the seminary, the Division of Church History, was the chairman of the department there. His wife, Betty, taught speech for 49 years. They're members of Hampton Park Baptist Church in Greenville, South Carolina. They have 3 children, 5 grandchildren, and he is still active in the work of the Lord. Though he's retired from teaching, he still travels from place to place and does exactly what he's doing here today. I had trouble getting up with him to talk to him about being here today some months ago when we were trying to arrange this. Finally got a hold of him and he said, "Oh, you just caught me in 5 minutes. Half an hour. I'm going to catch a plane to, I forget where, Kansas City. I'm gone again." So he's very active. We thank the Lord for that. I wonder how many people are here today who were students of Dr. Ed Panosian at some time in your past. Would you raise your hand? Look at that. For many years, every freshman at Bob Jones University had to take History of Civilization. And everyone who took History of Civilization had Dr. Ed Panosian. And I tell you, that was an amazing class. So with no further word, would you come?
Your pastor was on a good theme a moment ago, starting on John Calvin. I was hoping he'd continue, but alas, he sat down. And I must. It is true that John Calvin is a name that evokes a strong emotion. Almost no one is neutral toward John Calvin. He is either admired or hated. He is either feared or appreciated. He was used of God. He is the second generation reformer. Martin Luther was 25 years old when John Calvin was born. Calvin built on a foundation which God had used Martin Luther to begin. Now, for these next several minutes, I must ask your participation in what I am to do. I want you to imagine with me that I am John Calvin, and remove the obvious incongruities in your mind. I am not 500 years old. though I was born 500 years ago, John Calvin, July 10th, 1509. A few months ago, we celebrated his half millennium. Not many people are remembered 500 years later. Imagine that I am he, and I'm going to tell you the story of my life as if John Calvin has come to talk with you. I was born, I say, on July 10th, 1509. To Gerard Calvin, I was one of seven children, five sons, two daughters. My father was a minor official in the town of Noyon, in the province of Picardy, some 60 miles northeast of Paris. He was an official in the church, a lay official, and in the province. He had a civic responsibility, and he had connections with the church. Now, the church is the Church of Rome. It was the only organized ecclesiastical system. It was the perversion of the gospel which had prevailed in Europe for at least 500 years, perhaps longer. Here and there, there were pockets of believers, to be sure. But in my time, the dominant ecclesiastical institution was Rome, Romanism. I didn't like to hear it referred to as Catholic. I'm a member of the Holy Catholic Church, the church which you heard about earlier this morning. It was presumptive and false to assume that one particular institution of man's making was or is the church. Rome's presumption of assuming unto herself the ecclesiastical supremacy of domination of centuries of Western civilization was itself a contradiction of the word of truth. Well, because of his connections with the church, my father was able to acquire for me, whom he expected to be a servant of the Church of Rome. He was rather generous, he felt, in preparing his son to serve the Church of Rome. That was his opinion at the time. He obtained for me, I say, a benefice, a kind of a scholarship for my training. And it was in this connection that I began the study of the classics. I became proficient. Montague was my teacher. I went to Paris at the age of 13. I studied the classics. I studied Latin and Greek. I studied the philosophers of antiquity. In the midst of this, my father had a falling out with the Church of Rome. Not so much theological as administrative disagreement. And he now proceeded to deny the services of his promising son to the church, as he had formerly intended. And he now inclined me, my father, inclined me to the study of law. In the providence of God, this was an additional preparation for what I did not then anticipate. So I went to Orleans. I went to Bourges and studied at the universities there. In Paris, the classics, at Orleans and Bourges, law. And prospered. I was a serious student, I must say, beyond expectation. I did harm to my body by long hours of study and careless ingestion of food. I took one meal a day. I studied late into the night. I laid the groundwork for many physical difficulties in years that were to follow. I had dyspepsia, indigestion almost continually. I eventually had the gout. I had fever. I had the ague, and suffered much physically by the abuse of my body for the sake of study. Now, most students in your generation are not inclined to such excess, to be sure. And I must say I envied them just a little. It was in this connection that I published, at the age of 23, a work which was a commentary on the ancient Roman philosopher, the moralist Seneca, who had written a treatise on clemency, mercy in the execution of justice. It is interesting, as I look back on it, that I had at that early age an interest in this subject long before my spiritual reception of God's gracious provision of clemency for my soul. This was from a young classicist at the age of 23, I say, and demonstrated my growing proficiency in what was then considered the excellence of classical learning. I was a young classical Renaissance scholar and nothing more. After my father's death, I was freed, as it were, from the responsibility to continue in the direction of his preference for me, and was at the point where I had to make decisions for myself as to what my future would hold. I went back to the University of Paris, and there met a friend, Nicholas Kopp was his name, C-O-P, Kopp, who had been elected rector of the University of Paris. This was an administrative responsibility, not so much an academic one, and we became part of a little group influenced by a French centenarian who at the age of 100 published a French translation of the New Testament. Jacques Lefebvre was his name, and he was a kind of budding Protestant, and we became part of a little group that he led. And it was in this connection that as the young rector, Nicholas Kopp, was about to be inaugurated, as was customary, he had to give an inaugural lecture. As his friend, I wrote that lecture for him, and we together intended that it be the announcement of a reform program in the University of Paris. A reform of the scholastic dryness of medieval surmisings and a restoration of biblical teaching. We took the position that the scholars of the Middle Ages were ignorant of the gospel, and we were calling upon the faculty of the University of Paris to return to the scriptures as the source of their inspiration when they studied theology. Paris was known for the study of theology, as Orléans and Bourges were known for law. Now, this speech, when presented before the university faculty, led to a riot, an uproar by otherwise staid, robed scholars. They were incensed at such a suggestion and virtually rioted and stormed upon the speaker and his friends, and we fled. I fled in disguise to escape. Nicholas Kopp went to a neighboring city. I went as far away as I could. I went back to Noyon, and resigned my benefices. I had also become a chaplain at the age of 12, a do-nothing position, merely attached to an income. And I resigned any connection. I was not yet saved by the grace of God. It was indeed an enigma to scholars. I don't describe in any detail my coming to Christ, as did Luther, as later was to do Wesley and many others, Spurgeon, far beyond my time. I refer in the commentary on the Psalms, I refer simply in later years to my sudden conversion, where God Himself instantly brought me to submission. That's all I say, but it was no less real and no less true. Now, a mission to perform. Now, no longer a Renaissance scholar seeking to help the church to purify itself, but now setting about to a reformation. Much has been said about the relation between me and Martin Luther. I had many young friends who opposed Luther and thought he was rough. Indeed he was, and thought he was less refined, and indeed he was. He was also a German, and I hope I offend no one by saying that. And my French smoothness was a little more gentlemanly in some respects. But I refused to let any of my colleagues and students in later years say a word of opprobrium toward Luther. I admired, appreciated the labors that he had begun, and upon which we of later generations were to build. In connection with this event in 1533 at the University of Paris and the riot that it produced, a posting of the placards, posters, occurred on a certain night in August in the city of Paris. Posters were put up during the night, secretly, and they were discovered in the morning all over the city. Posters denouncing the Roman Mass as a vile perversion. One of these placards had boldly been posted in the king's bedchamber. So the first thing he saw upon awakening, and before his morning, he was confronted with this attack on the central sacrament of his church, this perversion of the ordinance of communion. And this forced the king, Francis I, to begin a process of severe persecution against these budding Protestants. We fled. They fled. I then went down to southern France, where the king's sister, Queen Margaret of Navarre, who was a woman of some piety, in order to help assist her in encouraging her brother to cease the persecuting of these young believers, with little success, and then proceeded northward to the city of Basel in Switzerland, a city which already had developed a significant printing industry, publication, printing. I cannot emphasize too much the significance of printing, movable type printing. In the middle of the 15th century, less than a century before my time, God had used men to introduce a mechanical scheme of rapidly reproducing words on a page. After centuries of handwriting, without any means of duplication except by handwriting again. In your generation, you don't even use carbon paper anymore, whatever that is. Your means of rapid reproduction of words. But do you remember when in later years, William Tyndale had completed a translation of the first five books, the Pentateuch of the Old Testament, from the Hebrew, and took ship to another town, during which there was shipwreck, and everything except souls on board were lost at sea, including the copy, which was not a copy. It was the original of the translation, which he was going to have printed in a neighboring city. The labor of months lost at sea, and no, what do you call it, backup on your, what do you call it, computer? Whatever those things are, you see. Now, a opportunity to reproduce mechanically, rapidly, multiple copies. It was as if angels now were our couriers. So rapidly could words be dispersed and spread abroad. I went to this city. And at the age of 27, published in Basel, in Switzerland, the Institutes of the Christian Religion. At the age of 27, reflecting and written in French, it was dedicated to King Francis I of France. On the assumption that he was ignorant of what Christians believed, of what these reformers were teaching. And surely if he were informed, he would cease his persecution. I dedicated it to him, I say, and presented the first edition, the first version of what was later edited, enlarged, many times since, of the institutions, the foundations, the fundamentals of the Christian faith. I was 27, I say. It was remarkable to me to learn in later years that this became the most articulate presentation of the doctrine of truth taught by the reformers. The essential foundational principles of the Protestant Reformation. It was not Calvinist or Calvinism. It was Christianity, defined and elaborated, and by the grace of God, disseminated throughout the Western world, translated into many languages, and reprinted and edited. In my dying year, I again revisited it and modified, edited, usually by enlargement, rarely by deletion. And therefore, the first edition was considerably more brief than the final one. Now, after 2 years in Basel, I went down to Italy, the home of the Renaissance, the place of the beginning of the restoration of the original languages and a reexamination of medieval presuppositions which had prevailed for many centuries. Duchess Renata of Ferrara was a woman of some piety, kindly disposed to the hearing of biblical truth. And I was assisting in trying to enlarge the movement there in the very land of the Renaissance origin. But soon the Inquisition's influence was to be felt, and I fled Italy and now took my journey back, I thought, to Basel or to Strasbourg, neighboring towns, I say Strasbourg, on the border between France and Germany. I'm not sure which I intended to eventually settle in. I thought I was going to settle in Basel, there to do the work of a scholar and serve God with my pen and publish that which would be of help to the reformers and their followers throughout the world. The direct route to Basel was hindered by temporary warfare between the Empire and the French, the German Empire and the French. And therefore I had to take a detour which took me to Geneva. Geneva, international city in Switzerland, where there stands today, on the edge of a park-like lawn in front of the library of the University of Geneva, a long stone monument, a virtual wall, it has been called the Reformation Wall in Geneva, perpendicular to which, at each end, is a monument to Martin Luther and Ulrich Zwingli, German reformers who had preceded the Reformation in Switzerland, in Geneva. And this monument contains more than life-sized statues emerging from the stone wall, over 100 feet long, of statues of various individuals, one of whom is John Calvin. I mention this because above the statues on this wall are three Latin words, post tenebras lux, L-U-X. Which translates, after the darkness, light. This became the motto of the city of Geneva. It was not yet so in 1536 when I arrived, but it was to be so. After darkness, light. For how many of you is that a valid testimony? After darkness, light. I say I had to stop briefly by the city of Geneva on this journey intended to either Basel or Strasbourg. It was July, most biographers say August, but there was a 2-week spread in there before I finally made a decision. I intended to spend one night in Geneva. Took a room in the inn, which was not only the inn for travelers and the restaurant for the hungry, it was also the center of news for anybody traveling through. Anybody who stopped was grilled, was questioned about what was going on wherever he had come from. The outside world. News traveled slowly, and it was travelers who were often its couriers. News was spread of my arrival. It had been just shortly before that the publication of the Institutes of the Christian Religion had been received. News of my arrival came to the ears of a young man who just 2 months earlier had begun a kind of reformation in the city of Geneva. William Farrell was his name, F-A-R-E-L, William Farrell, a fiery preacher, a red-haired Elijah kind of man. He was great at attacking and tearing down, and he had the verbiage to accompany it, but he was less gifted in building up. And he saw in my coming a providential opportunity to enlist me, rather to draft me, into the service of the reform in the city. And he pled with me to stay. I thanked him and refused his offer. And then he switched gears. He became a virtual Old Testament prophet. And he bristled at my resisting the will of God for me. And he swore that God would curse the tranquility of my studies, which I sought, if I refused to come to the aid of God's people in this hour of their need. I was quite surprised, and more than a little taken back, by this clarity concerning the will of God for me, given to another, but fearful of the threat which he had launched, I consented to remain. Took care of business, and in 2 weeks came back and began a program of reform for the city. I expected this would be where I would remain. The city of Geneva was a worldly city then, of about 12,000 inhabitants. Swiss soldiers were an important export of the city. I say the city, it was a canton, a state, a city-state. It had a semi-independent government, a council of 200, a council of 60, and a council of 25, which ran the city and made decisions and passed bills. And the Council of 25 was the continuous institution. The other councils met periodically. And it was customary in that day for the city council to determine the moral tone of a city. They passed regulations of social and economic and legal, political concerns. And there was great concern for the fact that these Swiss soldiers for hire, because of their evident quality as mountain men, Swiss Alps, rugged, effective, they were hired as mercenary troops by other people fighting wars. And they went off to those wars, and they came back with the sins and the experiences and the diseases of army camps back then. And they brought back much of worldliness to a city which was already sufficiently so. And there was a concern to establish regulations for moral cleansing for the city. At first, Farrell and I proceeded sermons and Bible lessons from the scriptures, and people listened and seemed attentive. But there was an underlying group of libertines, as they called themselves, which name itself suggests their attitude toward regulation and limitation of moral action. And there was an underlying resistance. Finally, on Easter Sunday of 1538, after 2 years in the city and 2 years of attempted building of a spiritual foundation. On the night before Easter Sunday, the citizens had frolicked on the shores of Lake Geneva with all kinds of dissolute behavior. And I refused on Easter Sunday morning to offer the communion to those, to such a city which had shown little concern for the piety and obedience to the Word of God. And this was met with the city council deliberating, and in 3 days they expelled Farrell and me from the city of Geneva and gave us 2 days in which to leave. It was almost as if I shook off the dust of the city from my feet as I continued a journey begun 2 years before and delayed by this episode. An unthankful people who did not want the limitations of the word of truth, who preferred their own wills to the will of God, and thankfully left and went to the city of Strasbourg. In Strasbourg were people, and still so today, I'm told, who speak French and German. It's on the border between those two countries. There were a number of French refugees who had fled the King Francis I's persecution. They wanted a pastor. I finally agreed to come, though I was resistant for a time because of my experience. I did not want any official position. But I became the pastor of French refugees in this French-German town. I taught at the university there. And while there, I responded to a letter sent by a Roman Catholic cardinal, Cardinal Sadoleto, addressed to the people of the city of Geneva, condemning those leaders who had led them astray, Calvin and Farrell, and graciously offering to receive them back into the Roman fold. A friend in Geneva, there were still a few, sent me a copy of that letter, and I responded on behalf of the people of Geneva. They were not altogether out of my system. And wrote a letter twice as long to Sadoleto, denying the infamy he had imposed upon them by the letter, and pointing out the ignorance of Rome concerning the gospel of Jesus Christ. And with that letter destroyed the pro-Romish party in the city of Geneva. I displayed by this response that I still had a concern for the people of Geneva. While in Strasbourg also, I took a wife. I was about 30 years old. I met and became interested in a widow of an Anabaptist leader who had died recently of the plague. She had several nearly adult children at the time, poor, godly. It was a new experience for this now maturing scholar. We had a daughter who died 2 days after birth. No, a son. And two daughters subsequently, both of whom died in infancy. So there was no progeny in the natural sense. 9 years we had together. enjoyable and pleasant years. And I describe with tender tone in letters after her passing to friends, which belies the charge often heard of my coldness of heart and lack of human emotion. While there now in Strasbourg, I receive an invitation from the city of Geneva again. Things have changed here. We want you back. We have come to prefer the moral limitations of the reform to the excesses of licentiousness in the city. No, thank you. I am not I've been there once. You do not want the government of God in your midst. They importuned and implored, and I fled to a neighboring town. Whatever is a neighboring town here, a few miles away, to get away from them. They followed me there and insisted, and I yielded. And in 1541, 3 years after being expelled, I was invited by the City Council of Geneva, and for the remaining 23 years of my life, I was a citizen of Geneva, a French-speaking canton or state among the Swiss provinces. Here now, the opportunity of building a catechism for instruction, a discipline for rules and regulations. We set out, by the grace of God, to make Geneva a remarkable example of the government of God over a people. You could not do this in your time. Your efforts to have done so in your colonial era proved to produce either hypocritical conformity or open rebellion. And you no longer consider tolerance a vice. You think it a virtue. I do not argue with you, but in my time, tolerance of dissenting opinion was evidence of holding no opinion as authoritative. This is revolutionary in your mind. In my time, it was the responsibility of the civil authority to protect its people. You still give lip service to that expression, but that protection in my time extended to moral protection, spiritual protection. And it was the responsibility of the civil government to determine the religion of its citizens. You find this foreign, to be sure. In my time, it was presumptively evident. As kings determine the religion of their subjects, so did republics do the same. And it was the responsibility to provide a moral barrier against civil disobedience, civil vice. We set out to make of Geneva a model city under the government of God, a city in which only those who had a genuine spiritual relationship with Jesus Christ would be comfortable and welcome. Those who had an affinity for it would remain. Those who did not would leave. And it was in these 23 years of the remaining my lifetime, that the city doubled in its population. Those who wanted this came to it. Those who later took the grand tour of Europe, which was considered the final part of the education of a sophisticated young person, wrote in their logs, their diaries, that they found in Geneva a wonderful peace and contentment and sobriety. You could not marry a wife in the city of Geneva without the approval, the examination of both parties by the city council. You could not hire a servant without an official review of the character of that servant. There was to be no one on the streets after 9 p.m. There was a curfew. Only those who were out making sure that there was no one on the street was out on the street after 9 p.m. on the assumption that nothing good happens after 9 p.m. You've changed that a little in your time. There was a deliberate effort to make an outward opportunity to assist the godly, to assist those who wanted to live rightly before God, to enable them to do so. This was not without opposition, but it was opposition that was never totally successful. And I must say, because some of you are thinking about it, that there was an event in 1553. It became a black mark on the city of Geneva. And some people know little more than this fact about John Calvin. There was in Europe at this time a notable scholar and scientist named Michael Servetus. He was a kind of Leonardo da Vinci. He could do everything but paint and sculpt. He was an inventor. He was a medical physician. He was a geographer, an astronomer. He was a technician. And he was a most vocal anti-Trinitarian philosopher. He set out to destroy the doctrine of the Trinity. He published a work entitled Errors Concerning the Trinity. That's intended to raise some hackles. He also took a copy of my Institutes of the Christian Religion and wrote in his hand marginal notations of all my errors. He published another work entitled The Restitution of the Christian Religion. Institution, institutes versus restitute. My error, the error of Christendom, was the doctrine that he set out to destroy the doctrine of the Trinity, I say. He had been condemned by Rome. His book and his person had been consigned to flames, and he effectively escaped their clutches. And of all the stupid things to do, he came to Geneva and made his presence known. He was arrested by the order of the city council. He was tried. He was condemned. I met with him in his cell, as did others, seeking to draw from him an acknowledgement of his errors and a surrender, a confession. He did not. He would not, not believing himself to be in error. And I attempted to mitigate the punishment. Something less than burning at the stake, without success. And in 1553, he and his book were burned in Geneva. In his dying words, he said, O Jesus, thou Son of the eternal God, have mercy upon me. But he denied that Jesus was God or eternal. Now, you will rightly say in your time that it was wrong to burn a man for his beliefs. Rome had done it many times, thousands of times, and was to do so for thousands of times more. was to burn witches by the thousands in Europe in centuries after mine. You and your opponents make a big thing of some 16 women burned in Salem, Massachusetts in one long hot summer. And you conveniently forget of thousands which Rome burned. It was wrong, you will rightly say, to burn Servetus. But in my time, just as in your time, if you have a cancerous organ, you do not hesitate to cut it out, lest it destroy the body. So also, of far more eternal significance, is the refusal to cut out a cancer in the body that is the church. And human sympathy took a seat behind biblical fidelity. Now times have changed. I understand that. I did not understand it in my time because times in my time had not changed. And you will acknowledge that this was wrong. And so it was. But I repeat what you should always remember. There has been but one perfect man in history. And he was the Son of God who walked upon this soil. This was a black mark, you may well say. It was in the month of February of 1564, in my 55th year, that I preached for the last time, having preached many times each week, sometimes several times a day, having carried on a wide correspondence and written commentaries on most books, I preach for the last time in my pulpit, St. Peter's Cathedral in Geneva. It had been the Roman Catholic Cathedral. It was whitewashed, not literally, but all the trappings of Rome were removed, and it became my pulpit. I never held any office in the city of Geneva except that of pastor. I was one of the pastors. Just a few years before my death, I was made an honorary citizen of the city of Geneva, but held no office there except by influence. Preached, I say, for the last time in February. They still show today in St. Peter's Church in Geneva a chair in which I sat before climbing up into the pulpit to preach. It's called Calvin's chair. Was carried to church in a chair for the next couple of months until April. Consigned to my bed in April. Drew up my last will and testament on April 25th. The next day, I asked for a meeting with the city councilors, all 200 of them. They graciously instead insisted that they come in groups to my bedroom for a final meeting and a final farewell. I took leave of them with tears and with great apologies for anything I had done to offend them, and bade them a final farewell. 2 days later, the city pastors, of whom I was one, came to my bedchamber, and it was Beza, my successor and biographer, who said, we departed with cheerful eyes and grateful hearts. And on the 27th of May, 1564, with the setting sun, I departed this life for a better. That Reformation wall in the city of Geneva that I referred to has four central figures. I'm one. John Knox is one. John Knox came to Geneva for about 2 years and was our Bible teacher in the little Knox Chapel that was built adjacent to the cathedral. And also is William Farrell, and then Beza, the biographer and friend and successor. Those four central figures. Then on the arms extending, on the sides are four additional figures, suggesting the influence of my work and Geneva and the Reformed movement. William the Silent, William of Orange of the Netherlands, the Dutch Calvinists, Roger Williams and the American experience, Brozny, the Hungarian, and who is the English? I forgot. Suggesting, I say, the long extended influence of the Reform movement in the city of Geneva. I expressly determined that there be no marker on my grave. I was buried in an unmarked grave, so that there would never be an adoration of a man, or even a remembrance of him. But I could not, as God has been pleased not to do, erase the influence of a lifetime and the outworking of a book which God has used in the Western world. After darkness, light. You cannot appreciate the extent of that darkness in the Middle Ages. I hope you can appreciate the breadth of that light extending to your day, this day. To God be glory. Amen.